Stuff I need
most of the answers, but you sort of say, okay, here's what.
Two and three are the same.
Subcommittees.
Corrective lenses.
Hi, Nancy Nelson.
Hi, how are you, Marty?
Somewhere yes. Along the way.
Good. Sorry for a bit of a delay in getting us started here. We had a lot of materials that needed to be copied to be handed out to you at the last minute, so we've gotten those distributed, and many of these will be referred to during the presentations, but I did want to just also point out we either have them in the packet or we will be handing them out before the meeting is over. Some materials about disease management and some materials about the Q-Care initiative. And those are materials that are also being handed out as homework for the Governor's Transformation Task Force. And so I just handed those out. We're handing those out to all of the working groups so everybody is, you know, on the same page in terms of the background information that they have, so that you can, if you haven't received that before now, you can take that home to review it. And then I also just want to say that Representative Thiessen is not here today, but he did work with me on putting together this agenda. His family's on vacation, I believe. So let's begin with the agenda. One of the things we've been looking at is cost savings that might be in the wings or underway. And one of the things we've been looking at is a pay-for-performance idea. And we're very fortunate today to have Carolyn Perry with us. Carolyn is the director of the Buyers Healthcare Action Group and is the first person that I ever talked with about this concept. And so welcome, and why don't you come on up to the table.
Thank you for inviting me here today, Senator Berglund. I have a handout for all of you that looks like this, and chances are the group in the back hasn't gotten it yet because I didn't know how many copies to bring. But it is to talk primarily about our program, Bridges to Excellence, and how, in fact, we justified it with the employers. I represent most of the large employers in the state through the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, a coalition of employers that are dedicated to healthcare reform. We've been working together for about 20 years, and what we did here is bring a national program to Minnesota, modify it to build on the existing infrastructure of Minnesota, and implement. So I'll be talking specifically about the return on investment figures we used up front in order to sell that program with the large employers, because, of course, they don't do anything unless they see a return on investment, and then how, in fact, the program is actually working. So the national program was started in 2001 by big employers like Verizon and General Electric, and it was based off a program that the National Committee for Quality Assurance had developed. A National Committee for Quality Assurance is a group that accredits health plans. So they go into health plans and measure how effectively the health plans are working with providers in order to ensure that their customers get high-quality care. It's a pay-for-performance program that rewards, the national program rewards, individual physicians. And it started out with three areas, diabetes, cardiac care, and then a thing called Physician Office Link, which was really intended to get physician offices up and running on electronic medical records. The overall focus is to re-engineer processes of care so that they're efficient and they're appropriate. And all the physicians that go through this program are accredited by NCQA and then posted on a website. So what happens is they apply to be certified by this organization. If they succeed, their name is put on this website, and then what these employers would do is pay their patients for each patient going to those doctors. So the doctors got bonuses on a national level of about $100 per patient that they saw. So the idea was to direct patients to the best care defined as that that NCQA had measured. Now, when we brought it here and we talked about doing the program in Minnesota, we decided that it probably wasn't best to post doctors on that particular website because it cost each doctor about $420 to apply to the website, and people wouldn't really use it. Plus, it was a static sort of thing. That is, once you applied, you spent your $420, you would sit on the website for 3 years. They wouldn't come back and measure you for another 3 years. So if you saw improvement or if you saw deterioration in your performance results, it wouldn't matter. The transparency that was there was based on that one point in the 3 years' time. So we didn't really like that feature of it. And we decided that actually for the measurement, the data as well as the standards, we already had some pretty good infrastructure built here in that we had had ICSI in place for at least 15 years, and we had now the Minnesota Community Measurement reporting on the results of the providers that were using ICSI guidelines. So we said, why would we necessarily need to adopt the NCQA guidelines and the program that they have and use an outside vendor to measure the results when we have these community resources that we would prefer to support and that seem to fulfill the program even better than it had been defined initially in the national program. Because the measures were developed by physicians, we obviously had buy-in right off the top, because through ICSI they had developed what, in fact, those optimal care measurements should be. In addition, we set performance targets each year, so it wasn't static anymore. We raised the bar. The employers wanted to raise the bar every year. It used Minnesota Community Measurement as the source for the reports and the information, and it provided additional transparency in that it was a public website that everybody could see, and that all the providers were ranked accordingly, one-on-one. Now we get into the money piece. There are three pieces of money that I'm going to talk about. First of all, on building program participation, when NCQA first came out or thought about how it would do this first measurement on their website, they hired an actuarial firm to go out and take a look at what would the savings be if you brought diabetics within control. And they defined control based on what you see here. Their return on investment assumptions were that if you control blood sugar, it's critical. If you control blood pressure, it's important. And LDL was important as well. And they calculated where you had to bring the patient from. So if you had to bring 7 is the best right now. Below 7 actually is the best. So if you brought the patient from 9 to below 9, you would get more money because that's a harder thing. Whereas if the patient was just a little above 7 and you brought him up below 7, that was a relatively easy thing. So and the savings were remarkable because somebody whose blood sugar is out of control at 9 or 12, they're going to have more issues, myocardial infarction and other issues that they're going to, or reasons for hospitalization, let's say, is the primary. But if you can reduce the blood sugar level, then the likelihood that these people are going to be admitted for some kind of emergency treatment is obviously lessened. Same with blood pressure control, bringing that in check, and LDL. Nephropathy just means, did they really look at your feet primarily to make sure that your nerve endings are still working? If they aren't anymore, chances are you're sliding out of control. Some of these other things, had they been taken care of, you wouldn't be at that point. They also looked at notation in a file of whether or not the doctor had talked to the patient about whether or not they smoke. It didn't say that they weren't smoking, and it didn't necessarily say that they were offering cessation advice. They also looked at the eye exam, and they figured that there was a savings there. But see, now you can see that these savings between the nephropathy exam and the eye exam are starting to come down pretty much. $77 per patient if you check your feet, and $1 if you look at their eyes. So this was kind of what they put together as far as what the savings were based on the Towers parent evaluation. And then on the next page, it says how they built their program. So based on each one of these individual measures, they said, okay, we're going to say if you have X percent of your patients meeting this particular standard, it's worth X number of points. And what we'll do at NCQA is add up the points, and if you get 60 out of a possible 80, you go up on the website. So that means that some of these measures could be hit or miss for different patients. It wasn't the same patient. It didn't mean that you had one patient that had all of these things in control. It meant I might have 20% with their HbA1c at 7, but their blood pressure might be totally out of control. It was just so that I'd get enough points in order to be posted on the website. Well, that was something else we really didn't love, because one of the things that we found was that ICSI liked the fact that we could use composite measures. That is, to really say a diabetic is in control, that is, there's an optimal measure, it would be five things that would be done or that would be demonstrated by that particular patient. And they are actually the blood sugar, the blood pressure, the smoking status to be not just documented that there was a discussion, but the smoking status that the patient was not smoking. The LDL had to be in check, and they added one measure that's not even here, and that was aspirin for every patient over 40. So that was what our ICSI was saying, and this here is what NCQA was saying. So again, when we tried to modify it for the Minnesota market, we said, why should we step backwards and go with a lesser standard? Why don't we use the ICSI standard? And as long as we're measuring to optimal in community measurement, let's use that as our basis for performance measurement and payment, which is what we did. At the same time, in the Bridges to Excellence group, Verizon and GE and others were doing their own study based on some other markets that they had brought up on the national model. And so they were actually looking at claims data. They were looking at episode groupers, if you guys have talked about that here, what it really costs to provide care to the whole diabetic. And they figured, based on their study, that for each diabetic that successfully went through the program, that was worth about a $350 medical save. So on the claims cost, they were saving that. But then they also calculated a savings in terms of lost time, productivity, absenteeism. So the total save from a Bridges to Excellence employer perspective was $700 per diabetic patient. And that's how they justified it, based on how they were paying.
Now, just let me interrupt you a minute.
Yes.
When you say per diabetic patient, you mean per diabetic patient meeting the guidelines?
Right, going to an accredited physician. So they're still using the NCOA guidelines. They're looking at those that have gotten the 60 out of the 80 points, and they're saying, okay, for each one of those doctors, if I have a patient that goes to any one of those doctors that are accredited, they get $100. But, you know, if somebody else is seeing my patient, there's no savings happening. They also looked at cardiovascular disease because they had those three goals. And they found the same sort of thing. That is, the direct medical cost save was about $290 per cardiovascular disease patient. And there was a savings of $548 for the lost time. Again, based on disabilities, et cetera, related to complications is pretty much how they'd come up with those productivity figures. Now the next page will show you what we decided to do here. And I mentioned it before, I highlighted our measures. So you can relate these back to the NCQA standards. But this is what we're saying a doctor has to achieve with a diabetic patient in order to be eligible for the rewards through our Bridges to Excellence program. We took the composite measure from ICSI, and through community measurement, we identify that the hemoglobin A1C has to be below 7. So there is none of this 9 nonsense. It's really good or not. LDL had to be less than 100. If you go back and you look at the NCQA standards, they allow for a little variation in that. But for us, we said it has to be at less than 100. It has to be documented that the patient over 45 is taking the aspirin. The smoking has to demonstrate that it is a non-smoker, not just that it's documented in the file, but they are truly a non-smoker. And blood pressure needs to be at the lower range of 130 over 80. And then what we said is, if you have 20% of your patients, or no, 10%, for the first year we said 10% of your diabetic patients meet these standards, you can get $100 for every diabetic patient that you treat that comes to you through the employers or the programs that are participating. So that was the incentive. Now, for cardiovascular, which we haven't rolled out yet, that will happen later this year, you can see that a lot of the measures are the same, but there are different values. And some of the difficulty in rolling this one out is what I'm sure you've heard about, comorbidities. So typically a diabetic may also be depressed and have cardiovascular disease. So we're still building the program so that we can adjust appropriately and pay appropriately for those comorbidities. But if we were looking at these as individual conditions right now, these are the measures that we would use for that condition, for that particular condition, as well as the payouts and the thresholds for those individual conditions. So you can see for cardiovascular disease, we're looking at, again, an LDL at less than 100, that everybody gets an aspirin, that everybody's a no smoker, and that their blood pressure has to be at 140, the higher standard, 140 over 90, but if they're diabetic, it needs to be lower. And our threshold that there, we're still trying to identify, because nobody seems to be able to tell us how many patients we should really have. I mean, everybody knows we should have all of them under control, but nobody really knows. It's interesting when you try to dig in and develop a pay-for-performance program how very little information there is available to really make solid assumptions. To summarize, what we decided we wanted to do, that resonates with you, Senator, when we looked at our ROI assumptions then, we wanted to ensure, since some of this was just a swag, I always like to say it's
I
like
think
swing.
We have one question about this chart before we go on to the next page.
Please, which chart?
I just wanted just a question. So for the Minnesota one, do the diabetic patients have to reach all five of these measures, or is it similar to the national where you get one here and one
there?
No,
it's all five measures. It's all or nothing in this one. I think what we've called it is the grand slam. The optimal measure is the grand slam. It's all five or nothing. So we're saying you have to have, and when we said to our employers that 10% was going to be the threshold for payment, our employers were shocked. Because when was the last time your manager said, well, if you do 10% of your job, I'll give you a bonus? So it was a hard sell,
right,
actually, with
and
employers.
And, I mean, you know, remember, we all believe we have the best healthcare system in the world. So how could we only be giving optimal care to 10% of our patients?
And when we started this program, we were at 6. The average population of diabetics that was getting the optimal care was 6% across the state of Minnesota. And we're at the best. We have ICSI. We have community measurement. But the best we were was 6%. So 10%, while it took a lot of convincing, once we could show people what we actually had, they said, okay, 10% is where we'll go. But we're going to accelerate performance improvement by raising the bar every year. And we're going to expect that there will be improved performance year over year. So anyway, the assumptions we made before, when I was talking about it's really hard to get some of this data, the employers were fearful that this could cost them millions of dollars. And, of course, every employer needs some kind of stop loss. Even when they're buying an insurance program, they need to be able to budget for what their ultimate exposure is going to be. So we took the most conservative estimate of what the cost would be, or what the savings would be, so that they could budget for that appropriately and what the reward payout would be. So what we said was, we'll take the $350 example, because some of the other Towers Perrins stuff would indicate, and remember, with the NCQA stuff, they didn't use a composite measure. They costed all those individual things out. Well, you would intuitively say, well, then that should be additive. So with each measure that you hit, you should obviously be able to come up with the sum of those savings. But it doesn't quite work that way for a number of different reasons. And thank God I'm not an actuary. But what they said at the end of the day was, if you hit the three big measures, blood pressure, LDL, and hemoglobin, you had a chance of savings per patient of about $1,000. Well, we were kind of nervous about $1,000. So what we said was, we'll take what BTE National is doing for the SAVE calculation, and we'll take that $350 on each, the medical savings and the productivity. So that's what we decided to do. And how the ROI looks is on the next page, and it's pretty simple calculation. Let me make sure I've got this right. Okay, if you see the annual costs and ROI as a specific example, we're looking at diabetes and vascular on the same page. We're taking basically the number of covered lives you have, and we assume a prevalence of diabetes or cardiovascular disease in those populations. And so we multiply the total by the prevalence, and we come up with the population that would basically be eligible for this particular care. Then we say, now let's assume that 20% of them are going to rewarded clinics. We had to come up with something because we certainly don't know which clinics or which doctors our patients are seeing. We know what care systems they belong to, but we really can't take it much further than that. So let's figure that 20% are going to rewarded clinics, and then when you roll the money up, that is what we would project as the save for the employer. And then, of course, you have to remove the cost of the program because there are administrative expenses that need to be paid, but if I could say, because we already built on the Minnesota infrastructure, that is ICSI and community measurement, we were running it at an administrative expense of $12 versus the national expense of $36 per patient. So we built a save-in for that. And this would be, obviously, then, your projected cost minus your save is obviously, or your save minus your cost is what you end up walking away with. So you can see what some of the sample returns on investment are. And the lower number is without the productivity save or the soft cost, and the higher is if, in fact, you also have a productivity save for both diabetes and then cardiovascular. Well, when we went out then to sell this to members or to employers or to DHS, we had these calculations done for each of their populations. So they'd have something that they could budget. And that should be on the next page, the annual costs and return on investment for DHS. We were thrilled to have the Medicaid population in. Medicaid here gave us, and we were first in the country to do this, they gave us their Medicaid managed care population to work with. We wanted to make sure that we could attribute patients accordingly. We wanted to be able to use community measurement. We wanted to be as careful as we could to ensure that we were attributing their clients to the appropriate physicians. So there was some work that needed to be done there. And this is what we came up with, and this is how it ended up. We first said that there are about 450 covered lives at DHS with an incidence a bit lower than the general population for diabetes. That is about 1.8%.
Now, and how did you come up with a lower incidence? Because
it was based on numbers we got from DHS. It's surprising because the sicker population, as I understand it, and they can talk to you more about this, is in their self-insured or their own program, the whatever you call it. I'm not the government person.
The fee-for-service, but they're doing pay-for-performance on the fee-for-service also.
But I think they have a sicker population.
Right. Well, they told us the last meeting we had, they were here, they told us they had about a 6% more people with diabetes in their programs than you would find in the commercial market.
And that could be, I would ask them if that's in their fee-for-service program, because it's not here in our experience. As a matter of fact, if you look at how it actually came out, their prevalence is actually lower. And the prevalence that we have on the side-by-side here, the 1.4, actually comes out of their claims data that comes through the plans. So that is what we have as actual prevalence for DHS.
Okay.
So anyway, when you run through the numbers, we were saying what their annual costs would be based on the service fee and then the payout, the reward payout. And you can see then that we said the direct savings would be about $574,000 based on the projection. It actually came in more around $273,000 based on the reduced prevalence. And we didn't build in, actually, the productivity cost when we gave them their numbers. We showed them what it would be because it's relative to the overall program. But since they aren't really paying for that productivity, we kept it out. So the save they should have seen, really, is $117,000. So on the right-hand side of the page, the actual save out of the BTE Diabetes Reward Program is $117,000.
Well, the interesting thing is that they told us that over a four-year period, this particular pay-for-performance idea would not even pay for the bonuses. So that's why you're here. We're trying to figure this out.
Well, I don't want to start a fight. It's just the facts, man. Just
well, we
facts.
Don't believe it. We don't believe it. We're trying to find out how we could figure it out, you know. So this is helpful.
Well, I can compare them with the employers and simply say that the employers actually bank the savings, which is why we are very conservative, because obviously if you're going to bank savings, you don't want to bank something that you don't have. So we went with the 350 because it's so incredibly conservative as compared to the $1,000. In addition, when we went and we constructed the program, one of the reasons they have a lower number than you would anticipate in terms of a save is, again, we built in also a stop loss because we didn't know where our patients were going. So we said, okay, if it exceeds $20,000 at any given medical group, that's a cap. And what we'll do is we'll prorate it to each person or each group based on their membership in the program to adjust for that hitting that cap, if that makes sense to you. I used to be a risk manager, so I talked about caps and stuff all the time. So if anybody's confused, please let me know. But that was the stop loss on the entire program. So when you look at DHS's proportion amount of that, it brings their number down even further. So we felt that we had built this program so very conservatively that you could bank off the estimate.
Senator?
Question, yes.
I'm still confused. How did you calculate annual savings?
It's dependent on the experience related to people that are out of control. Diabetics that are out of control have admissions for certain conditions.
But did you actually calculate the admissions and compare them to a previous year, or are these still estimates?
Powers Parent, this is estimates, again, based on the research that was done through the National BTE program.
So, but it's still actuarial.
Right, that's right.
Okay. So my understanding is that the savings that are anticipated are future savings because you're preventing future conditions. So how does your group anticipate such a rapid return on investment?
In the decreased claims cost over the year of investment.
I'm sorry?
Over the decreased claims cost in the year of investment.
Has these actually been observed?
Well, this is our first year, so we'll go into our claims data now for the year and find out.
So in other words, I think one of the resolutions to the discrepancy between the numbers that we're seeing here and the numbers that Vicki Kuhnerth gave us last week is that it's a disagreement about estimates. It's not actual reality.
Right.
Well, I could agree with that, but that is how DHS builds their budget. They estimate how much something's going to cost, and they put it down as a request, and then they estimate how much things are going to save, and they put it down as an offset, and they do that all the time, and that's why we have budget revisions to our budget forecast periodically, because if something's off, then you revise your budget.
I have another question. My understanding also is that the nature of the data are such that it's impossible actually to attribute a medical group's quality for its entire patient population. It's impossible to attribute that to different populations. In other words, the populations that are covered by the employers and the population that's covered by DHS. Is that your understanding as well?
In some cases, it is right now because of the way the data is collected and how it's stored. But you can, in fact, for instance, we have, and in the background material, you'll see who all our champions of change are that are in the program. You can identify the patients, and you know where the patients have selected to go for their care. You can't necessarily take it down, though, to individual doctor level, because you'll never know. If you walk into a medical group right now, and they're all practicing together, you might get a different doctor on a given day based on what your needs are on that day. So it's very difficult because of the way we capture data and the way we pay claims to identify specifically the physician and even the clinic. But at the medical group level, you can tell what patients are going to that particular medical group because they all have a tax ID number. So you trace it back against the tax ID number.
And we are asking the Community Measurement Project to oversample compared to what they have sampled in their chart reviews for our public programs to try to determine whether our public programs are similar in baseline to what they're doing with the general population, or if we have a different baseline for our public programs. And that information should become available this fall sometime.
It's very difficult right now, too, with the data to pay the right people for the right care that they're providing. And so if there's a plea, I know I'm not on the soapbox today to talk about this, but the state of the data is in such horrible shape that nobody knows either what they're paying or what they're getting paid. And that's unconscionable in any kind of business setting. So, of course, my plea is always for better data, objective data, and public data. If you can go into the CAD then program, again, these are just estimates because we haven't rolled it out yet, but the same methodology applies. What is the anticipated save? With DHS, the save would be less because, again, we aren't building in the productivity. What's the projected prevalence of the disease within the population that's in the program? And then what would we anticipate as being the threshold? What we haven't really decided on 100% is how we'll set the threshold for optimal measures. Again, there's no data that we can rely on, so we're guessing. And as part of the Guiding Coalition, and you'll see this in the background information, DHS sits on the Guiding Coalition who helps us decide where we set the thresholds and how we do the payouts and how we design the program should we have to when we hit those proration caps. Okay? Let me just tell you, though, some of the things. I felt that this was important because these are learnings on the community benefits. These are learnings we've had through the program that I think are even more valuable than the return on investment we've seen thus far.
Can I just ask one question about this CAD sheet? What you've got down here for medical savings is 522. What you've got for annual fixed costs is 405. And then, you know, you said the low end of your range of potential ROI is without the productivity numbers.
It's without the productivity, and it's the money that's spent. So the savings amount should be without the productivity numbers.
So this would be savings,
the
taking the 405 against the 522.
522 is the savings, and then you have to subtract the 405 because it's the cost of the payout as well as the administration of the program.
Okay. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes. And, you know, I was just working some numbers and figured, you know, if we could get all of our diabetics going to clinics that were providing optimal health, just a quick back of the envelope, it would be about $87 million would be the total save. And the administrative cost, we'd have to calculate that out. But there's a great opportunity in managing diabetes and coronary artery disease. But what I wanted to mention on the community benefits page, because I really think some of this stuff is so critically important to sustain programs like what we've done here. And what we've found as we've now got two or three years of this under our belt is that broader participation, and this is what's really important, having the Medicaid population in our program, is that the broader participation of all these stakeholders increases the signal strength in the market. What we used to always hear is that the public programs ask for different performance than the private insured programs. And because of that, doctors never knew what to do. And not only that, every health plan would ask the doctors to do different things too. So doctors could never achieve a good result because they didn't know which result they were supposed to chase. What this does is that all the buyers are saying, this is what we expect relative to measurement. And if we got that measurement, obviously, we would have a lot more people well. What we've gotten the plans to do through this program is to agree to align their performance measurement with the Bridges to Excellence performance measurement. So if you asked a doctor today what they were supposed to do for diabetes, they could tell you what the five measures are. And everybody would be working toward those five measures. We've also been sharing best clinical practices. In the first year, we found 9 medical groups that were performing well, that is, they were hitting the 10% threshold. This year, we have what we did was we took those 9 medical groups and we compared them with the lowest rating medical groups to see what the best practices were. And 2 big things came out. One is whether or not they had an EMR so that they could have the registries to help them provide the care that they needed, but also that they could create management reports so that they could share information with the doctors in their business so that the doctors knew where they stood in comparison to other doctors. and how sick their patients may be. So what that did was that created, but that was one. The other one was if you have a certified diabetic educator working with your patients, you'll see a better result. And we heard from pretty prominent care systems in our market that said, we got money through a grant proposal to do this kind of treatment with these certified diabetic educators. But when the money dried up, we had to discontinue the program. But we can tell you the program really worked. So what that says is that's to the next next bullet point is useful in value-based benefit design. Employers now, and I'm sure DHS too, are looking at value-based benefit design to say what should we pay for based on health outcomes as opposed to what should we pay for based on cost. It started out with the idea that you could put expensive drugs with no copay. Pitney Bowes and Marriott and big corporations tried this and said, well, if we put better drugs with no copays, that means that those sick diabetics will use their drugs, will have higher compliance, and will have better results. Well, what we're trying to do is incorporate even more of those kinds of ideas into the benefit programs that we design so we can ensure that every diabetic is getting the services they need in order to achieve the optimal results. So there should be no barriers in that. One thing providers said was, we don't really believe that health plan data, that is, claims data, is really accurate, and we really don't like a pay-for-performance program based on inaccurate data. So those of us that have EMR want to give you our data directly because there won't be any questions about that data. It's encounter data, so it can tell you everything. So we've gotten providers now to submit direct data on diabetes, which allows us to identify by clinic, not just medical group, but by clinic, who is achieving optimal. So in the Fairview system this year, we recognized about 13 clinics within the Fairview system that had achieved out of their how many. Let's pretend they have 40. They have a lot. There's a lot of variation within those clinics. So if before you thought you were going and getting the best care just by going to Fairview, you don't necessarily know that because there are some high performers, and I mean like 38% of their diabetics are under control, whereas some low performers have maybe 6% under control. And they see that variation, and they use the information on the variation to help their providers with quality improvement. So in the cardiovascular program, the only eligible people for the cardiovascular payout will be those that do direct data submission. Now, recognize that since direct data submission really works best if you have an electronic medical record, so it makes it easy to feed it, this now creates a business case for providers to get an EMR because if, in fact, they have an EMR that they use and they report with, they can earn more money. So while the national program originally wanted to reward, you know, let's give money up front for having an EMR, just for having an EMR. Our program, luckily, we didn't think of this in advance, but was designed in such a way that it actually gives the physician the ROI up front on how they should install an EMR. The results in this program are completely transparent, not only to the providers, but to the public. If you go out to the website today, you can see how all providers are listed relative to how they're providing care for diabetics. And so anybody can make a decision where they want to go and get the best care. And it has accelerated performance improvement. As I mentioned before, the average when we started this program was 6%. We went up to 14% this year. And as I mentioned, we were saying that we had a clinic as high as 38%. Within the Guiding Coalition, they're not sure that they can achieve the 80%, but they know they can get to 50. And how fast they can get there is anybody's guess, but I would guess by next year we should have some clinics that we're seeing at 45. So it really has accelerated performance improvement, and that's my testimony.
Ms. Perry, have we also seen clinics that were at the bottom improving? I mean, they may not get to the bar that has been set for them, but is everybody improving as a result of this?
It was interesting because in the first year, the performance improvement that we saw, the lower-ranked clinics were coming up, and even some of the rewarded clinics had come down. So it is one of those things that you want to stay relatively vigilant on in terms of your identification and your payment so that when somebody sees that last year they were up higher than they were this year, they're obviously going to pay more attention to this particular program.
So do we know how much we've improved in terms of the averages?
The average has gone up from 6 to 14. Next year, we will, for 2008, We will set the threshold at 30%, because, again, we did see them. We still saw people at zero, and then we saw people at 38%. So we want to continue to challenge the market in setting a goal for excellence rather than average.
Questions? Yes, Pete.
Carolyn, you had mentioned that you were going to be doing a after-the-fact analysis of actual savings versus estimate. Do you know when you're hoping to have that?
Well, it will depend on individual employer, and we've been through the program once. So I would guess sometime, probably early next year.
Representative Abler?
I'll just keep it to one. Do you think that the motivator, I don't see the motivator for $100 to a clinician as being anything that they're going to be very excited about, but I can see that perhaps the aggregate money to a system would give them some staff they could do, they can buy some better equipment. And plus they have the doctors themselves, at least what you hope there you think of, is they want to be driven to excellence anyway. They want to know the rules. And they work pretty hard, by and large. And so is that what you think, too? You think it's the money doesn't drive the individuals, it drives the systems and gives them some resources to kind of do what they want to do anyway? Is
absolutely,
that what you
think? And I should have mentioned that earlier. That's a very good question. We didn't, if you notice on the national program, they wanted to pay physicians directly. We agreed early on, because of our legacy with ICSI, that it's really the system that supports the physicians that makes them successful. So we would prefer to reward actually the clinics or the medical groups as long as they reinvest it in quality improvement. I mean, we can't tell them where the dollars go, but we certainly would hope that that's how they're spending the money.
Other questions? Ms. Roden.
Ms. Perry. I was very interested in the comment about the value-based benefit design as being part of this, because it seems that the combination of, one, incenting the doctors to do the right thing and making it easy for the patients to do the right thing seems like a very nice combination. But the question I had was, when you talked about the two things that seemed to make the biggest difference was the electronic medical record and the certified diabetic educators, and it appears that you figured out a way to sort of indirectly incent the EMR. Have you been thinking about ways to incent the issue about the certified diabetic educators as well?
Yes, most of our employers are self-insured employers, but administered through one of the big health plans here in the Twin Cities. And so we want to work with the health plans to help us with that benefit design. As part of the Guiding Coalition Task Force, we're currently trying to identify what certified diabetic educators, how they are currently reimbursed, and how they're reinforced, how their use is reinforced through the existing plan designs that we have out there. And then we want to adjust those plan designs. So we have a work group right now that's looking at how we would do that.
Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, I have one comment and one question. I mean, you had the comment that the DHS incidence is lower in diabetes, and I just offer to the group that that's likely because that population is younger with a high number of kids, so you might expect a lower incidence. And then I'd like you to comment on the inclusion for the DHS estimates of productivity numbers. I mean, typically those are included for an employer analysis because the employer has the potential to enjoy, a benefit of that, of more time at work or more whatever. But I guess the state enjoys it in the sense of a greater good. People can work harder or do whatever, but it's not really a savings to DHS. So I'm just wondering if you could comment on your logic.
So that's why we did not use it in the calculation of their save, right, because they don't have any control over that and they won't see any returns on that.
Okay. Thank
you. I would just like to amend your statement. We have all of our elderly in our public programs now in Minnesota in managed care.
Well, they are all in managed care, but relative to a commercial population, I think still on average the DHS population overall is going to have a younger average age.
Well, I guess we'd have to ask them, but we do have a large number of elderly that are in our programs also. And we have a certain number of our disabled who are in managed care, and we are moving towards statewide managed care for disabled populations.
Okay. Well, I meant it to say it's possibly a factor in that incidence difference.
Yeah, it could be. It could be the point at which they were at. But they are also doing pay-for-performance for the fee-for-service market. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think the information that they gave Ms. Perry in terms of their managed care was all the information she should have had to figure out their save.
Okay.
because they are doing it on their fee-for-service, and that is all of the disabled population.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Other questions? Yes.
Two questions. One to follow up here. If a patient is dual eligible, Medicare and Medicaid, do they get included in this population? And the
I have no idea.
Okay. The second one is when you mentioned the variation among clinics in achieving goal, was there any attempt to look at differences in the characteristics of the patients that went to those clinics?
We have not done that analysis yet, although from a disparities perspective, it would be very it would be wonderful to know. We know that there are some clinics, however, that are serving the underserved and doing extremely well, but that's anecdotal. It hasn't been borne by the data.
Other questions? Yes.
Senator Berglund, as one of the providers in this, I'd be happy, I shouldn't say this, but I will, we'd be happy if you want to hear from some of our providers or Dr. Linares or Allison Page to talk about it from their perspective, if the group would be interested in hearing that at some point, or obviously meeting privately with you from our perspective.
Well, we're not focusing so much on how well it's working, although we hope it's working well.
Well, how
we,
to get
the reason that we have
savings.
That in front of this group is because we're trying to look at things that will be recommended from some of our other work groups that potentially might have savings, and while we're waiting for that, we are looking at things that we know we already are doing that could have potential savings so that we can kind of analyze how much these different initiatives might have in savings. And so that's the reason that this is here. And I think that this presentation has been very good in helping us to understand how you make the case for the savings and has reinforced my skepticism at the DHS fiscal staff's estimates on this in this area, and I'm sure we'll be having further discussions with them about that. Any other questions? Yes.
Just to comment, I don't think there would have been any reason that the duals would have been excluded because, as Carolyn mentioned, the Medicaid patients would have been oversampled, and I don't think there would have been an exclusionary piece for the duals, particularly because they would have a lot of those conditions. So that would be my understanding of that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Very good presentation. Next, we're going to ask Dr. Schiff from DHS to come up and talk about an initiative that we entered into now, I guess it would be almost 3 years ago, to, in our public programs, eliminate payment for unnecessary services. And there had been a study done previous to this to look at whether there were things that we were paying for that might be unnecessary. And the conclusion was that there wasn't any one service that should be eliminated, but that sometimes the services were being provided to people who didn't need the services. And so the savings DHS felt would happen over a long period of time, about 10-year period of time, because they would not be able to implement the reduction of payment for unnecessary services in every area all at once. The different ones would be phased in over different periods of time. And so we asked Dr. Schiff, who was a medical director who was hired as this project began, to come and talk to us about where they're at with implementing this program.
Thank you, Senator Berglund, for the introduction. My name is Jeff Schiff, and I have the privilege of serving as the first medical director for the Minnesota Healthcare Programs. As Senator Berglund said, the role that was created through the what's mostly known in this state as the Baylitz study that looked at ways of improving the value of the Minnesota Healthcare Programs. The We began this program a little over a year ago in June 2006 and really have worked to try to include evidence-based medicine in the development of the benefits set for Minnesota healthcare programs. What I want to focus on today, and for those of you in the committee, have a multicolored handout, and I hope there's enough for a good share of the audience. I want to focus on the creation of the Health Services Advisory Council, which really helps us structure our evidence-based benefit set, the a little bit about evidence-based medicine and how we've implemented it, and then some of our new work on new clinical delivery systems. And I think hopefully this will dovetail well with Ms. Perry's presentation on some very specific diseases that she talked about. The I see that the role that the medical director at DHS has is really to help develop that benefit set, to help develop new clinical delivery systems that could be applied for this population. But put another way, I think that this role is a role to help engage the provider community in creating value for the healthcare system, and that one of our key drivers has to be that we have to get providers to think about the value of the services they deliver at the point of service where almost all of our healthcare decisions are made. At the same time, I think some new work needs to be done around engaging patients and families in care delivery. Our work through the Health Services Advisory Council and the work I'll talk mostly about centers on our fee-for-service population. And as was just discussed, the fee-for-service population consists of the majority of that population is approximately 106,000 individuals who are disabled. As you'll see on in this handout, the Health Services Advisory Council started about a little over a year ago. And I want to acknowledge Ross Owen, Mary Pohl, and Chris Reisdorf, who are the staff who work with me on this. The Health Service Advisory Council is a group that guiding principles are really to increase the value of the healthcare programs and to increase the quality of what we cover. The members of the Health Service Advisory Council are set by statute and include 9 physicians, including at least 3 health plan medical directors, a psychiatrist, family practitioner, and 2 allied health providers, and 1 public member. This constitutes 12 individuals, the 13th being myself as ex officio. Currently, we have, as allied health providers, a chiropractor and a nurse practitioner. A public member also serves on the committee. The committee is chaired by an elected chair, Kathy Brooks, and meets 9 out of the 12 months. As I say to this committee, and I will say to this group as well, we are both building the pipeline and trying to fill it at the same time, as far as evidence-based medicine is concerned. I want to talk now a little bit beyond what the structure of HSAC and talk a little bit about evidence-based medicine. Evidence-based medicine, like some other terms we use, is a little bit like mom and apple pie. Everybody has their own definition of it. It's really been studied in a lot of places that up to a third of the healthcare that's delivered is not needed or ineffective. One of the challenges is to find good evidence and then to apply that evidence well. On the white sheet, I have a handout that came from an article from Sean Tunis. And I think this is a very good summary of the challenges we face in developing evidence. It really consists of just 2 boxes. In one box, it talks about the analysis of the evidence, and that even in that box, there are scientific judgments that need to be made about the rigor of the studies, the quality of that information. And from that analysis of evidence and that information about outcomes, we still have to move from there to making value judgments about preferences for individual patients, which really inform policy decisions. In this simple 2-box diagram, what we really say is that we can provide the analysis of the evidence in the department to talk about what's out there and the quality of the scientific research. And then we rely on HSAC, the Health Services Advisory Council, to provide the value judgments about how we should cover policy for our population. And as was said earlier by the senator, there are always it's almost never the case that there's something that shouldn't be covered. It's almost always the case that we need to decide about when to cover what services. Our goal overall then is to decrease variability and increase appropriate utilization of services. On the next handout, the pink handout, I wanted to go over for a little bit the challenges and the rewards of selecting specific topics for topic selection. As you can see on this pink handout, we actually, in somewhat of an order, have said these are the criteria by which we will pick topics to consider for Health Service Advisory Council evaluation. Patient safety is by far and away the most important criteria. And an example of where we think patient safety has come into play in the work we have done so far is around the issue of bariatric surgery. In our population, we found that bariatric surgery done at centers that are recognized had a mortality rate half of those of that of centers that of places that weren't recognized. And we felt that this was an important issue to have criteria that our centers that do bariatric surgery are approved by an accrediting organization. Similarly, there have been articles recently about concerns about radiation exposure for some of our tests that use a lot of radiation, like coronary CT angiography, and the risk of subsequent cancers from those. So we feel like our primary goal first is of patient safety. The second thing then we look at is efficacy and outcomes. And we find that we need to look to see whether or not a therapy is as effective as as a comparable result. Lumbar spinal fusion is the situation where we're finishing our work on right now in this regard. Lumbar spinal fusion, although it is important for certain patients who have neurologic deficits, has not been proven to be as effective for patients who don't have true objective neurologic findings. From patient safety and efficacy of outcomes, the next thing we look at is variability of practice patterns. One thing we've started to do is to actually look at some specific tests that we may or may not be able to impact through prior authorization, but to impact through knowledge to the provider community. An example of that is the use of CAT scan in the emergency department for head injury. One of the things we found is that while that number has increased, the number of cases that go to neurosurgery, which is probably a good indicator of actual patients who need intervention, has stayed steady. And we will use data from situations like that and data from other practice areas. I pick on my own area of the ER, where I come from, first because I know it best, to help inform providers and actually hopefully have them move the mark on quality based on the data that we're able to provide them. Existence of established alternative treatments and technology is the next thing we look at. And I bring that up because it's the approval by the FDA of devices is really requires only safety and effectiveness. And it does not require a comparison to established existing choices. So one of the challenges that states face now is of the approval of devices that may, while they may be safe and effective, they may not be more effective than other choices in the market that are less expensive. Volume and cost implications are the next things we look at when we talk about topic selection. And there's always there's a tension around whether we look at low-frequency, high-cost services, such as spinal fusion or bariatric surgery, or we look at high-frequency, relatively lower-cost services, such as imaging. And that really gets into our discussion of how we try to move the provider community. For services where there's a relatively high cost and a relatively low frequency, prior authorization is probably the most effective manner. But for services where there is a very high frequency and a relatively low cost. The cost of the prior authorization as we are currently structured at DHS has made it prohibitive. And that's specifically true, as I'll talk a little bit more about imaging, where we've had to make some tough decisions about whether or not we would prior authorize imaging internally at this time with our current prior authorization system. Potential future costs is the next thing we look at for topic selection. And genetic screening and coronary CT angiography are excellent examples of that. There's a slew of genetic screens that may be very, very beneficial for select patients, but the cost and the efficacy of these as more and more come on board for any for a broad group of the population has to be very carefully looked at. The next criteria that we look at are how impactable these are through policy channels. And things like use of air ambulance or abdominal CTs in the emergency department, which is almost always done to rule out an acute process, are things that are harder to look at through policy channels and prior authorization than are some of the other things I described earlier. And the last thing I wanted to be transparent and put on there are some things are politically sensitive and we sometimes debate whether or not they are things to look at, such as the whole issue of circumcision for newborn males. Well, those are sort of the criteria we use for topic selection. We bring topics from this then through HSAC in a process that includes us providing the evidence and then asking HSAC to make the value judgments that are needed based on that evidence to create policy. Some of the things that are brought through right now are bariatric surgery, which is in place, lumbar spinal fusion, which is not in place yet, PET scans, vacuum wound closure, things that we are working on but have, as I said before, and I'll talk a little bit more about, that have been a little more challenging is the whole issue of high-tech diagnostic imaging. It's been challenging for us because, as it now stands, our method of providing prior authorization is through a vendor, CDMI, which is an affiliate of Blue Cross. At that, we pay a certain amount between $20 and $25 for every prior authorization that goes through. Even if that scan does not need prior authorization and CDMI only says to us, well, you don't need prior authorization for that. So we made a decision earlier on that prior authorization for imaging for the thousands of scans done through that mechanism could not be done effectively in real time, and we needed to find some other alternatives. The alternatives came in terms of a Medicaid transformation grant that's been funded that we're working on, which is called Communication and Accountability for Primary Care Systems, and through some work that's being done through our healthcare operations division. And in that, we will, over time, build up some capacity around these issues. The last thing I want to say about implementation of these as we talk about it is one of the things that I consider and our group considers as we do this is how we can move the community of providers together. There are several examples that have come into play in regard to this. While we were working on the imaging pilot, ICSI, the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, developed a pilot project with six very large medical groups about utilizing their doing real-time decision support. So a provider would essentially look up on their computer system as they ordered a scan whether the indications were met or not. And if they were met, the scan would go through. If they were not, they would either be audited or edited, or they would be advised about whether they wanted to continue doing the scan. The outcomes from that process took place at the same time that some of the health plans actually have put in their own diagnostic imaging prior authorization criteria. It appears from the preliminary data that has a decreased effect on ordering of scans and a decrease both in terms of scans being reoriented as well as a sentinel effect in that providers are not ordering scans for reasons that were not so important in the past. Those are some of the issues around the evidence base for actual clinical criteria. I want to talk for a minute now about evidence base and using evidence for new clinical delivery systems. This year, the legislature funded provider-directed care coordination, which is an opportunity to begin to work on primary care payment reform for our fee-for-service Medicaid community. This grew out of work that the pediatric community did with the Medical Home Learning Collaborative, co-sponsored by the Minnesota chapter of the Academy of Pediatrics, the Minnesota Department of Health, and DHS. The results of that group of 3,500 children have looked very promising in terms of looking at decreased hospital days for children who are in this Medical Home Learning Collaborative whose care is coordinated, and also things like decreased ER utilization while at the same time showing that these patients are getting the primary care preventative services they need. This was approved by the 2007 legislature. The state plan amendment through CMS is still pending. We this fall will have a conversation in the community and are beginning to plan this actually tomorrow around what exactly is involved in care coordination so that we know that this type of care coordination is a different service than what is traditionally done in primary care at this time. We need to from there define the population that will be served, and this will be a population of our fee-for-service disabled patients who are above a certain threshold as far as utilization. These patients who are cared for by these clinics will then be paid on a per member per month for the provision of these services, which will include things like care coordination in real time at the provider level. They will include things like care plans that address the patient's needs. And it's anticipated from some of the other models in other states that this will save significant money. Our fiscal note for this was based on a savings of 5% in this population. Other states that have shown this have shown savings in the 15% to 20% range. Other clinical delivery system models that we're involved in is the is an ICSI project on depression called DIAMONDS. It's a community-wide effort to diagnose and treat depression in the primary care setting. Depression is a disease with comorbidities that are far-reaching in terms of seeking additional acute medical care for non-mental health reasons, as well as the actual cost of productivity. In this project, the primary care physicians will co-manage with psychiatry when needed. They will have there will be a defined care coordinator role, and again, as I said before, they're primary care focused. Other clinical delivery systems that will be implemented over the course of this year will be a community health worker program to help match and provide services in terms of education and care coordination between patients who are of minority communities and patients who are in and their providers. We know that community health worker models in other urban settings around the country have been effective in decreasing costs because the patients who don't always understand their instructions, who don't always get their care coordinated or know how to follow through, will have an advocate of their own ethnic background. Other things that that we've worked on in clinical delivery systems that are exciting are the we have a second Medicaid transformation grant in called MinHive, which is a health information value exchange. This is a community effort to build a single IT health record interchange that will be used both to interchange data and to develop over time price and quality transparency, such as Ms. Perry talked about, in a much more robust way. All of these things are projects that are, as the Senator said when we started, in the pipeline. And I would like to be able to say to you now, boy, we have this much savings booked on this or that. But I grew up with depression-era parents who told me you can't count the money unless it's in the bank, and so we don't have that quite yet. Future work, we already have enough work cut out for us already, but we are with this stuff, is that we see DHS now as a key partner to help move the entire healthcare market. We have, courtesy of this legislature, some things in place that make the healthcare market in Minnesota unique, and this is not news to any of you. Those include things like nonprofit healthcare plans that actually participate in more cooperative efforts than in other states, Rule 101, which obligates contracting to health plans if they're going to receive to the Medicaid program if they're going to be a contractor for the state employees. Other things I think we need to look at a little more carefully in the future are the possibility of centers of excellence legislation so that we can have mechanisms to identify the best providers and to steer our clients in that way without restricting access. As I talked about, we need to build our in-house prior authorization system to make it electronic, streamlined, and accessible to providers for this fee-for-service population. And we need, over time, better risk stratification of what care coordination looks like as we stratify patients so that somebody who is very complicated, perhaps in a wheelchair on a ventilator, receives more coordination than somebody who is much less complicated. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Doctor. Has any of the work that you've done, clinical work to date, have you estimated any savings being generated?
The imaging work, we have about, in 2006, in our fee-for-service population, we spent $23,600,000 on high-tech imaging. And I think it's really hard to pick a number that's exact as far as what we save. If we were to save 10% of that based on the sentinel effect of the what the plans have done and what the collaborative effort has done with ICSI, that would be significant savings of $2.3 million. Some of these other things that we have, such as the bariatric surgery and the spinal fusion, are a little bit harder to get at. But I'll just give you some examples just so for the discussion. Spinal fusion surgery in 2005, we did 251 of these surgeries at an average cost of $22,400. I think it would be hard for us to say exactly how many of these we could eliminate. If we eliminated 10% of those, we'd save $1 million, but I don't know that I can. I don't want to give you a number that's hard and fast on that because I don't think we know, for example, how many of those spinal fusions were done with neurologic findings that were true versus those that weren't.
And are you trying to track it in any way so that you will know in the future?
Yes, absolutely. We have, for example, for imaging, we built a standard report which looks at our high-tech imaging counts per member per month and our high-tech imaging reimbursement cost per member per month. And the good thing I can say, but I don't think I think I would be doing the statisticians a great injustice, but we're level right now. So over the last year. Now, whether that's a sentinel effect of all the press that's happened around high-tech imaging or whether it's just statistical variation, I really can't say yet. But reports like this will continue to run out over time, so we can say at the end of next year or at any time our procedure count per member per month is at the same level or higher, our cost per member per month is the same. So I think one of the things that I'm excited about doing, and this is something that I would welcome the input of this group, is what are the metrics that we should have in terms of holding us accountable for these costs as we move forward. And I think that what we really need to do, and this is some of our work for this fall also, is to build a series of reports that we look at over time to find out how we're doing as far as managing costs for some of the services as we try to impact them with prior authorization, with the work of HSAC, with care coordination.
So none of the savings that you think you might be getting up till now are in the forecast or have been booked against the contracts for the managed care plans, or
the savings. There have been some savings booked initially for the creation of HSAC and the creation of my position, and there trying to think, and there are savings booked for provider-directed care coordination as well that are already booked.
No, I know the things that we did this year that had savings booked,
right.
But I'm talking about this specific elimination of unnecessary procedures.
Right. We have not booked those savings.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
I know the clock's moving, and I think Dr. Schiff and I should sit on and chat out of this place, but I just want to ask one couple of questions about this, just as it helped me understand. I believe a couple years ago that you were directed, the department was, to pre-authorize the imaging, I think. Is that
right?
Yeah. And you're doing that kind of, or are you doing that? I wasn't clear. The plans are doing something, and you're working
right.
on, is it done?
I'll be honest with you that I came to the department in the middle of 2006. The prior authorization for imaging was due to expire on June 30th of 2007, and it's not that that was the mandated from the legislature. That was not in place when I came. We did not feel like we could actually get that in place in a cost-effective manner for that deadline, so it was not put in place for that. Currently, the prior authorization for imaging is only happening for our managed care patients. It's not happening for fee-for-service yet. And the reason for that, I just want to be clear, is that the mechanism we have for prior authorization is through the CDMI vendor, where providers would have to call every time they wanted a scan. The cost of that, we calculated, would be more expensive than the amount we would save by doing prior by having the limitation on the prior authorization of tests.
Madam Chair, do you remember that having a sunset?
Yeah, I remember it. So the question that I have now is, there were savings attributed to implementing that. Have they been backed out of the budget so that the forecast does not anticipate those kinds of savings?
I don't know if those savings were backed out of the budget or not. I can find out, though.
And I can't help but say one sentence and I'll be done. You know, we thought it made sense at the time. I don't remember the sunset, but apparently you do.
Well, Frank put sunsets in everything.
Oh.
Right.
Because it was saving money, and there was a controversial to the providers. I know they didn't like it very well.
Right.
And but we thought it made sense because I think there was, like you say, a 10% savings to be had if it could be somehow orchestrated.
Right.
But in terms of not so much you, but just the department, you know, we passed a law thinking that something's going to get done. You know, we said do this, and like it seems like they're bound by the laws we pass. Maybe they're not, but like in the broker thing, they didn't do that either this time,
right.
Abolishing the broker, and that's kind of an issue. So just as you talk to folks, when we pass a law, we really mean it. Okay, you know, and so tell us it's a bad idea. You sit there and say, oh no, you can't do that, but it's. It only makes it worse for us. So thanks for telling us directly as you did.
You know,
I appreciate that. So.
I hope that my relationship with this group is transparent. And I am.
But I might just add that if I hadn't asked you to come here today, we wouldn't have known that you weren't implementing this high-tech imaging legislative initiative that we did enact. And so that's just an FYI that,
right.
You know, there probably does need to be better lines of communication.
Point well taken. And I guess I want to be clear is we will be implementing a high-tech imaging prior authorization. And we already have. And the other thing I should say, Representative Abler, is in six groups which represent a significant percentage of the DHS practice, there is high-tech imaging authorization happening at the point of care in those groups through the ICSI process. So that is occurring.
And do we know if we're getting any savings because that is happening?
Well, Dr. Fazio and I talked about that this morning a little bit. I think we're the beginning of that process for most groups happened between March and June. So we're just starting to get the data in. And it appears like we will get significant reductions in the use. We have, as I told you, have this report where we're running on this. We do not have results beyond December of 2006, so I don't have information yet to say whether or not that's been effective in reducing it, but we'll be tracking that. We'd love to come back and be able to tell you.
And Madam Chair, I just want to encourage the good doctor. You're just the messenger, we realize. So we just come again, you know, you don't have to lose sleep to come back again. We're not going to be so tough on you, but It's,
oh, that's fine.
It's,
no,
it's good
I
you're here.
You
we do need to know.
You have, we should be accountable.
Other questions? Thank you very much, and good luck. next, we have Kevin Restow and Colette LaFond, who are going to give us a presentation about approaches to ascertaining the affordability of health care for different income groups. Welcome. We do need to move along. We are have another working group coming into this room yet today, so.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. My name is Kevin Restow, and I'm Education Director of the Jobs Now Coalition, which advocates economic opportunity through research, education, and advocacy. Founded in 1983, the coalition consists of 115 organizational members. It is the oldest and largest employment policy coalition of its kind in the country. Much of Jobs Now's research centers on one question. What is a family-supporting wage? As far back as the mid-90s, we decided that the best way to answer this question was to get public data and construct family budgets that measured the cost of meeting the basic needs of food, housing, health care, child care, clothing, and transportation. To figure these costs, we created a family budget methodology that has since been replicated for all 50 states. Over the past 12 years, we've responded to the demand for this family budget information by creating a series of reports titled The Cost of Living in Minnesota. In our most recent study, we figured the cost of basic needs in 2006 for seven different types of families in all 13 of the state's economic regions. And if you go to our website at www.jobsnowcoalition.org, you will find an interactive wage and budget calculator that contains family budgets for 18 different types of families in all 87 Minnesota counties. The calculator features an innovative software design that allows users to plug in their own budget numbers whenever they differ from Jobs Now's average cost. If you look at your handout, the first budget you'll see is for a metro area family of four with two workers. The average annual cost of meeting basic needs for this family is about $55,000. On average, each worker must earn at least $13.19 per hour in order to cover these costs. Since housing and childcare costs are especially high in the metro region, the health care costs of $396 a month end up being less than 9% of the total budget. When looking at this budget, please keep in mind what's not in these budgets. The basic needs standard here is based upon monthly budget requirements needed for a no-frills standard of living. If you look at the second page of your handout, you'll see that no money is included here for debt payments or skills training. There's no entertainment budget, no restaurant meals, no vacation, and nothing for emergencies, retirement, or children's college education. The basic needs standard falls short of what's usually called a middle-class standard of living. Staying in the metro area for now, let's see what happens with a same-size family when one parent stays home with the children. On your next page, you'll find that far less income is required to meet basic needs when a non-working parent provides child care. Instead of the nearly $55,000 required for a family of four when both parents are working, only about $36,000 is required when one parent stays home. What this means is that this type of family needs 34% less income than a family of the same size with two workers. So why doesn't one parent stay home more often if so much less income is needed to make ends meet? We can find the answer by looking at the wage requirements. Remember that when both parents were working outside the home, each worker needed to make at least $13.19 per hour on average in order to make ends meet. In this family, however, a worker must earn at least $17.30 per hour to make ends meet. In other words, when one parent stays home to take care of the children, the other must find a wage that is 31% higher than the wage that's required when both parents are working. Sticking with the same type of family, let's look at a budget for South Central Minnesota. In this part of the state, housing costs are 35% lower than in the metro area. The annual income requirement for this family is about $10,000 lower than in the metro area, and the wage requirement is almost $5 per hour lower. Since our health care costs of $396 per month remain unchanged, health care ends up being almost 20% of the monthly total in this family budget. The last budget in your handout is for a single parent with one child in northeastern Minnesota. Because of much lower housing and child care costs, the total monthly budget costs are 22% lower than for the same family in the metro area. Health care costs for this family are $248 per month, which is about 10% of the total monthly budget. And now for a description of how we arrived at these health care numbers, I'm going to turn it over to our lead researcher, Colette LaFond.
To expedite things, I'll give a very general overview, and then I can take questions on it. Basically, we tried to look at these costs in a very realistic way, in the way someone sitting down budgeting for their own family would figure them. The healthcare component is probably the most difficult one to arrive at a single budget number because so much depends on the specifics of the family's healthcare situation. What we did was try to arrive at a single number by figuring costs for a family if they obtain healthcare through an employer, healthcare insurance through their employer, and then for a family if they are compelled to buy health insurance themselves at non-group policy rates. And then we provided a weighted average of the two of those based on the populations in our state that are either covered by their insurance with their employer or are purchasing it individually. So about 74% of people, families in Minnesota, are covered by insurance through their employer. The non-group insured, we included all the uninsured people plus those currently buying insurance through direct purchase. We broke out, or we calculated what the employee contributions would be for the employer purchased insurance. Based on surveys, the medical expenditure panel surveys done by the federal government for Minnesota, and those were broken out by the size of the family. So our numbers are sensitive to the fact that larger families will pay more for their employee contributions. For the non-group premiums, we simply used a quote service on the web called eHealth Insurance Quotes, and we fed in specifics of our various families. And then the out-of-pocket expenses, we calculated for those with who have employee-covered insurance, we calculated those based on survey information. But for the people who are buying non-group insurance, we actually ran through the numbers based on the specifics of their policy. And we used a standard policy of a $1,000 deductible with a 20% coinsurance for all of those. So we tried to be very realistic. We didn't take a low deductible policy because, in fact, there's a greater trend towards higher deductibles. This makes it very difficult because the families that we're dealing with have no cushion, so we had to try to incorporate in enough so that they could cover the average medical costs. So again, these can be widely varying based on whether you have a serious health condition in the family or not. So if there are any questions about the specific components or anything.
Questions?
I guess not. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Then the last thing we have on the agenda today is a chance for our Senate Fiscal Analyst, David Godfrey, just to go over some information that was handed out earlier that he has provided in a more standardized format for us. And I'd like to just give him a few minutes to talk about it. It's a sheet that looks like this.
Madam Chair, working group members, you should have in your packet a one-page, two-sided handout of tables. And what this is a summary of the work kind of in a table form that Randy Chun from House Research handed out, and that was this document here during the first meeting. And what it does is compare enrollee premiums for state-subsidized insurance programs in a number of states. And I'll just kind of give you an orientation of this, of the actual table itself, and then I'll just make a few notes orally on the different programs. But what you have here are basically first, beginning with Minnesota Care, premium amounts by household size, monthly gross income, the federal poverty guideline, the percent of the federal poverty guideline, the premium amount that that household with that income would pay, and what percent, what the premium is as a percent of income. And I just mentioned that the premium amount that's paid by household is the total household amount for that premium. It's not for the individual. So, for instance, on Minnesota Care for three household size of three, the amount of $260 at 245% of poverty would be the total premium amount that household would pay for those three individuals. And then just I'd like to just go through and just point out a few things on each individual program. Minnesota Care premiums represent the premiums that are in effect as of July 1st, 2007. They include all the legislative changes that were made in the prior session in 2007. Families are eligible up to 275% of poverty, and adults without children are eligible up to 200% for fiscal year 07, and then that income eligibility goes up to 215% in fiscal year 08. And then I'd also like to just note that the percent of the premium, the premium as a percent of income does not vary on between household size. Essentially, it goes from 1.5% up to a maximum of 8.8%, regardless of household size. The California Governor's Plan, which has just been proposed, also does not vary. The premium as a percent of income does not vary based on household size. It starts at a low of 3% percent of monthly gross income up to 6%, and people are eligible up to 250% of federal poverty. The Illinois program is a kids-only program, and in this program, the subsidized premiums go up to any household with 799% of poverty. You have the opportunity to pay full cost at 801%, and the maximum premium as a percent of income varies by household size. So, for instance, with a household size of one, the maximum premium would be 4.4%, for two, 6.6%, and for three, it's a 7.9% percent of income. And then just turning it over, we have the Massachusetts Commonwealth Care Program. Eligibility here is up to 300% of poverty for a subsidized premium, and the maximum premium as a percent of household income varies depending on household size, and the maximum premium here is 8.8%, similar to that's in a household size of three. Pennsylvania program, which is a children-only program, Cover All Kids, which has been enacted, goes up to 300% of poverty, and over 300% of poverty, families are able to purchase at full cost. And again, the maximum premium varies by household size as a percent of gross monthly income. On the Vermont program, there was only data that was available that I had for a household size of one, and that's why you only see that represented here. And you see the premiums vary from 4.7% of income to 13.3% of income. And then finally, the Washington Basic Healthcare Program has been enacted. This represents premiums for households, because at least based on the information I have here, that no premiums are charged to children under this premium schedule. That what you have here are basically the premiums for adults in a household of either one adult or two adults, regardless of the number of children. And the what's notable here is that the premiums vary after 100% of poverty based on age as well. And so, as you can see, if you just go to household size of one, under 186% of poverty, the premium could range from $45 to $215 per month, which represents a percent of income of between 2.8% and 13.5%.
So I thought it would be easier to kind of compare if we had a more standardized chart, and so that's what this is trying to do. And, you know, this isn't the only thing we need to look at in terms of trying to make recommendations to the full commission about affordability, but it's the easiest place to start because we have a lot of comparable data. We will be looking at presentations in the future to look at other things that could be done and look at whether they would be affordable or not. Are there any questions about this chart, Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair, it'd be interesting to know how much they pay providers. You know, is it related to Medicare payment? Is it related to medical assistance payment? Or is it a commercial rate?
Well, maybe you could ask your researchers to look into that. I think it's a little bit out of the scope of this work group, however. So we're looking at affordability in terms of whether people can afford health care coverage or not. Ms. Roden?
Well, the two things I'm thinking of, both of which I think are going to be hard to get the information. There's going to be a lot of information, but I think that we need to consider is not just the premium cost, but the out-of-pocket piece of it. Because, I think if we're thinking about if there's going to be a standard of what's affordable, we need to consider both of those things. And then the other issue would be what the coverage actually is, which I know I wouldn't want to be the one that had to collect all that stuff, to be honest with you. But, I do think that that's also needs to be considered, because I know for some of the Massachusetts plans, they're high deductibles, and that begins to factor in a lot more than, even though the premium piece may be reasonable, the actual access and care and getting the care you need may not be. So I think, and I don't know necessarily how to grasp that, but I think that those would be important things for us to consider as we move ahead on this subject.
Well, I think getting that data from Massachusetts would be easier than getting it from anywhere else, because they do have standardized products that were bid on, and so we know how much the deductible is in, the high, medium, or low version of a plan.
I can do it from Illinois,
and
too.
We are in the process of putting together an analysis of that. Especially looking at people who are 45 to 65, because those are the ones that have the higher premiums, and therefore affordability becomes a greater issue. And we'll be presenting that at a future meeting when we get that data put together. Are there any other questions on this sheet? Yes.
I was wondering, when I'm looking at the Pennsylvania Cover All Kids, when you get to 300% of the federal poverty guidelines, it says full cost, and I know a lot of people have problems with mandates. Is that actually, are you mandated to buy into this policy in Pennsylvania, or can they keep their own coverage? How does that work?
They're not mandated. I think the only place where people...
is Massachusetts.
And it isn't even really all people. Some people are mandated to have coverage in Massachusetts, and then they have this... a couple of criteria that you can be excused from the mandate, and one is affordability, and one is, you know, family catastrophe. And so they actually anticipate when they have their program fully implemented that they will have about 5% of their population that will not be covered, which is troubling to me because the people that will be represented in that 5% will be people who need the coverage maybe the most. But, you know, nobody's gotten there yet, so I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying I don't think they're all the way there yet.
Okay.
Questions?
Well, actually, I just wanted to draw people's, if it's okay, draw people's attention to one other report that was in the folder, which is somewhat similar to the Jobs Now analysis, but it's from California, and it's actually specific to the issue about if you have a household budget without health care, what can you actually afford in health care? And the one thing that they do that's interesting is they look not only at the average cost, but if you're a high-spending household, what then, how much that balloons what your real health care costs are and what you could actually afford. So I just wanted to draw people's attention to that because I think it's an interesting addition to the work that Jobs Now has done on the Minnesota budgets.
Just for kind of planning purposes, I think not the next meeting, but the meeting after that, we will probably, we hope, have enough information so we can have a discussion of the working group about affordability and what kind of directions we think we should be going or what other information we need or what we think we should be making back to the working group in terms of recommendations. Anything else today? Thank you all for your good attendance. We appreciate it.
Talked to her about it yesterday, and she's like, oh, that's fine. We'll see if we can get them in. Yeah. If we'll meet our next working group. Right.
So they're probably using the same as what I'm the same equation.
Yes. No, the only one I've like written over there is...
Our next scheduled one is the 5th. I'll try to call you Thursday or Friday. Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Ye
we didn't have it.